I'm not your toy. Hello, and welcome back to the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. It is Sunday, the 20th of November, 2022, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Churn. Churn, how's everything going? We're hurtling towards Christmas at this stage.
We are certainly hurtling towards Christmas. Christmas lights have been turned on, the Christmas crowds are back here, and but most importantly of all, it is World Cup starting in Qatar in
it is,
weird
yeah.
time of the year.
Tomorrow, and England, Iran. Hopefully England can get off to a good start, but I don't have as high hopes as I had the last couple of tournaments, but we'll see. We'll see.
We'll see indeed. And if not, we can just play Scarlet and Violet, frankly, over the winter period.
Exactly.
Anyway, Sam, it's been lots of things have been happening in the world of sports, culture and stuff like that, and even politics as well, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And we've got a bumper episode today covering two elections. One that has already happened at the beginning of November in that whirlwind of elections when we had three within one weekend. So we'll be picking up on that. And we'll also be looking ahead to the upcoming state election in Victoria, Australia, where Premier Daniel Andrews is running for a third term. But Churn, I think first let's look back at Israel, which had its general election on the 1st of November. And obviously the introduction song for this week's podcast was the last Eurovision winner from Israel, which was Netta Toy. And what better way to begin a discussion of Israel's election, where you can never really write off Benjamin Netanyahu, can you?
No, you can't. It's one of those people where, you know, it's like the Monty Python sketch, isn't it? For the you just can't really get rid of him. So just to give everyone a bit of context, this is Israel's fifth election in 4 years, which probably, apart from us who are political nerds, must be some idea of hell having to go through the ballot box so many times. In the 120-seat Knesset, which therefore you need 61 seats for a majority, a closed-list proportional system with a 3.25% threshold. The Likud party, led by Benjamin Netanyahu, has got 32 seats, which is an increase of 23.4% of the vote. Yesh Adid, led by Prime Minister Yair Lapid, has got 24 seats, which is up 7, with 18% of the vote. The Religious Zionist Party, which came in third, with 14 seats, which is up 8, with 12% of the vote. And National Unity, which is actually an alliance between the blue and white, which is actually an alliance between Benny Gantz of blue and white of last time, and a New Hope, has got 12 seats, which is down 2 with 9% of the vote. And the remaining 38 seats have gone to 8 parties across the political spectrum, from the left-wing Labour Party to the far-right parties and religious parties. But nonetheless, the outcome, I think, in terms of this election is pretty certain, is that Benjamin Netanyahu will return his third stint as Prime Minister with the support of 64 members of parliament. He had previously governed Israel from 1996 to 1999 and 2009 and 2021. And before he even takes office, he would take office where he's already Israel's longest-serving Prime Minister. So, Sam, first of all, let's start with our usual question when we review election results, which is, what is your reaction to these results?
Yeah, I mean, the initial reaction is not one of huge surprise, because I think going into this election, it was anticipated that the pro-Netanyahu bloc within the Knesset would get the majority required to form a government, and that that majority would include the religious Zionists, who are the more extreme right element of Israeli politics, who are coming to the fore for the first time. So it's not necessarily a huge surprise in terms of the overall result. There are a few surprises lower down the ballot in terms of parties that did or did not manage to cross the threshold. But I guess to the package of results as a whole, not a huge surprise. What about you?
No, like you, I'm not really surprised, to be honest. I think that this election was coming because obviously I think what prevented Netanyahu last time around from forming a government was the fact that he was had been in power for a long period of time. So there were enough people wanting to get rid of him. And he is still remarkably under a cloud of corruption charges against him. So it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out in the months and years to come. And I'm sure you're going to discuss that in a little bit more detail. But I think one reason why Netanyahu's return was probably not that surprising was the previous government that had preceded, which only had a narrow 61 seats out of 120. And that government, as I said earlier, was primarily, it was a lot of ideologies in it, from the center-left to a far-right, now under former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, consisting of 8 political parties. So that, I don't think, could have helped throughout Israel's 3-year term.
I think when we covered the election last March, I said something along the lines of, forget Rainbow Coalition, this is every single colour within the Dulux paint catalogue. And I think that did sum it up in terms of the breadth of this coalition. So yeah, it's not a huge surprise that didn't necessarily work out.
Exactly. And once the initial thing that bound them together, which is Netanyahu coming back into power in the next 6 months and to get down to actual policy, then the cracks began to show within the coalition partners. So I suppose, Sam, given that purpose, which was, I think, as you said, the huge ideologies it makes, are you surprised? It must be, to its credit, it survived more than a year in office, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we covered the formation of that government last year, we were both kind of expecting we'd be back at the polls in Israel relatively soon because of the breadth of this coalition and the fact that they had 61 seats, which is the required number for a majority within the Knesset. So they couldn't afford to lose anybody for this government to maintain majority control within parliament. And actually, that is exactly what happened, because the floodgates opened earlier this year when Yamina, member of the Knesset, Idit Silman, quit the coalition over a decision to allow hospital visitors to enter with leavened bread within the Passover period, which is forbidden in Jewish law. And that left them without a majority. Then that was followed by a Meretz member of the Knesset, Gaida Rinewi Zoabi, who quit in May, citing the government's increasingly hardline stance on the Israel-Palestine conflict. So I think if you look at those two departures from government, which left the government with just 59 members of the Knesset, you see the issue with the breadth of this coalition. Because on the one hand, you had people who were very pro-Israel within the Israeli-Palestine conflict in terms of the applying Jewish law to the entire country and the settlements, versus someone who thought the government was being far too hardline on Palestine within the conflict. So it all fell apart because you could not bring those two approaches together in a way that held all 61 members in alignment at all times. And ultimately, that's what caused this government to implode over the last few months.
One point on that is that Meretz is often seen as the most left-wing of that entire coalition, and Yamina was seen as the party that was led by the former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, was the only far-right party. So it was really those at the ideological extremes getting frustrated with the government and therefore deciding to leave it, kind of showing, you know,
bizarrely, the final straw within this government, which was the straw that brought the cannibals back, really, was one thing that actually the government and opposition both agreed with, but the opposition saw it as an opportunity to bring down the government and evidently succeeded, which was the failure to pass legislation to renew the application of Judea and Samaria regulations on the West Bank. And as I said, Netanyahu's Likud bloc did support this. They supported the extension, but chose to vote against it to destabilise the coalition. And ultimately, the reason Naftali Bennett resigned, which is what he cited, is the fact that if you were to call an election, you would delay the expiration of these regulations until 90 days after the formation of a next government. So the election was really the only way to prevent these regulations expiring just because they couldn't get everybody to vote for it in the Knesset.
Well, actually, here's a funny thing, Sam, was that you talked about Gaida Romari-Zobi. She actually rejoined the government a few days after, actually. What the straw that brought the government down to 59 and therefore a minority was another Yamina MP, member of parliament, Neri Oakbarch, who left the government because they felt that he felt that there were so many left-wing members were holding the government hostage. And in a way, if you look at that government's composition, they were the only far-right party in a government that was more center-center-left leaning. So I think there could have been grounds for concern around that. But I think that by that point, you had instead of an office-seeking motivation, which was what brought the parties together, there were policy differences that driven it apart. And there was no way it could govern. And that's what brought about this general election. So, Sam, I suppose the question we next move on is we've given you the background. We've talked to you about the results. I have a question here. How was Netanyahu able to win it? Or is it more likely the case, I'll set out my stall for this, is that Netanyahu didn't necessarily win it, but the previous government or his government parties lost it? What do you think, Sam?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question because I can see both sides. So, I mean, on the Netanyahu side, it's important to remember in last March's election, which was the last time Israel went to the polls, the Netanyahu bloc wasn't that far away. As we just talked about, the opposition had 61 seats in total, which was a bare majority, and the pro-Netanyahu bloc just missed out. So Netanyahu was never defeated in this enormous landslide which would resign him to Israeli political history. He was always within touching distance of regaining power, and that's just last year. So I think that's important context, and it was always the case that if he were able to slightly boost the support of his party or other parties within the pro-Netanyahu bloc, they were within hundreds, thousands, potentially tens of thousands of votes away from reclaiming power. And that's exactly what they did in this election. On the opposition side, however, you had a bit of a split because the Israeli political system is proportional, but it does have that threshold of 3.25%. And if your parties miss out on the threshold, and then your bloc misses out on seats representing that amount of the vote, even though the other parties within the threshold will still get seats proportional to their share of the vote. So it's not splitting the vote in the same way it happens within single member constituencies. But nonetheless, if your blocs were to come together, for the main example in this election, I think, is Meretz and Labour, who famously failed to come together in advance of this election, which was actually something that Yair Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid, was urging them to do for the sake of the anti-Netanyahu bloc. You ended up in a situation where the Labour Party did cross the threshold, but Meretz just missed out. But if you'd have had that around 3% of the vote from Meretz added to Labour, they would have got that proportion of seats. Whereas in this case, Labour got their proportion of seats and the 3% attributed to Meretz got nothing. And that was reallocated amongst the parties who did cross the threshold, which in this case, the four parties who did the best were all the pro-Netanyahu camp or Yesh Atid, who within the anti-Netanyahu bloc did well themselves. But within this political system, just doing well yourself is not going to get your bloc into power. So that's where I can see the two angles coming from, but I haven't quite decided which one I'm more in favor of. I think it was a cocktail of all of those things.
Yeah, I kind of lean towards the latter part, which is that the government lost it because that final point in the end, that 3.25% threshold, is that I looked at parties that fell below that. Meretz, and you brought up the failure to cooperate to strike a deal between that and the Labour Party. a Jewish home, ironic, which is a party of the former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, within one election cycle, they were out of parliament, which I think is, there are very few examples of that come to mind, of such a dramatic fall from grace for that party.
The Joint and Arab List disintegrated as well, and which led to Balad falling out of the Knesset entirely.
Exactly. And it's all these little things. And these are all three parties that were in the previous government, whereas there were no parties that were in the opposition that failed to get back into this Knesset as well. So these small little things that matters as well. And let's take a look about the surviving parties within that survived this election and got into the Knesset, is that with the exception of Yesh Latid, they all lost seats. The most dramatic of them was the Labour Party. You know, if we think of the history of Israel, this is the party of Golda Meir, you know, who got 46 seats in the first Knesset. You know, it was the closest party to get an overall majority in Israel. And now is looking at 3.7% of the vote, the lowest vote it has got as a single party. And with four seats down three, it is the second worst performance in history. In fact, in this Knesset, it is the smallest party. So it is quite a fall from grace for the Labour Party. And there's also national unity, as I mentioned earlier, lost seats as well. Benny Gantz, as you remember, was thought of as an alternative prime minister. Israel Benigno, who was the party of the outgoing finance minister, he also lost seats. So he just lost seats all over the board. And frankly, they never really had a chance, to be honest, in my opinion.
I saw an article that CNN had put out, which did some calculations in the background and said that if the threshold was still at 2%, which it was just prior to 2014 when the legislation changed that threshold, actually the anti-Netanyahu coalition may have even gained seats in this election. So that 1.25% difference in the threshold clearly in this election made a massive difference, which emphasizes the point we're trying to make about the failure to unite, to bring yourselves even further across the threshold, potentially cost them government entirely.
I agree. I mean, and I think as the entrails would think, people will talk about this as a missed opportunity, isn't it, for the opposition parties. Yes, you could argue circumstances, given the formation of the government, this first has made it very tenuous. But I suppose the next question is for these opposition parties is, the perennial question is that Israel seems to be stuck in a loop of Netanyahu being weak enough that he can't cobble together a consistent government, but the opposition not strong enough to take advantage of that. That could be for a myriad of reasons, corruption reasons. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu is very polarizing himself. Everyone in Israel has been in the political scene for such a long time. People know him. So I suppose the next question is, when is Israel's next election? Is it going to be in 3 years' time, or is it going to be shorter, Sam?
Just quickly before I answer that question, because I think that is the perennial question, I will say one thing, which is another thing that illustrates, I think, why this might have been a Netanyahu win rather than opposition loss, which is, and we've been talking about this for a few weeks for those who are regular listeners to our podcast, is that Netanyahu went into this election as the preferred prime minister. He was polling in the mid-40s to Yair Lapid's high 20s and Benny Gantz's mid-teens. And one thing we've been saying a lot with recent elections all over the world in the past few weeks is, if you go into the election as the preferred prime minister and you hold quite a sizable lead in that polling, it's very rare that you go on to lose, because even in systems where it's not presidential and they're not electing one person, the top of the ticket matters. And we've got a lot of empirical evidence over the last few weeks. And I'm sure we're going to be talking about this when we talk about Victoria in the second half of this podcast, is that these kind of poll ratings matter. And I think Netanyahu holding a lead in that department did matter in this election.
I just find it extraordinary that somebody who has been in politics for so long yet can still be preferred prime minister, you know, for even after all that period of time. Yeah. It is quite extraordinary, just the context of that, isn't it, Sam?
Yeah. But to go back to your previous question, which was about whether this government will last, I think it's really uncertain, because one of the biggest blocks within their group, which is the difference between the pro-Netanyahu forces being in government or the pro-Netanyahu forces being 10 seats short, is the religious Zionists, who are the reason Netanyahu is able to get back into office. And yes, they do share some similarities because they share the opposition to the creation of a Palestinian state and skepticism over the interventions of the High Court in various aspects of Israeli politics. But the religious Zionists are far more extreme. They advocate for the expansion of the illegal West Bank settlements. They want immunity for Israeli soldiers from prosecution and dramatic reversals of LGBT rights expansion, just to name a few. So bringing this coalition together and holding it together might prove to be quite challenging because the leaders of the two prominent parties within the religious Zionist alliance, Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, want control of the security and defense portfolios. Now, a lot of international allies of Israel, including the United States, have allegedly told Likud and Benjamin Netanyahu that if those people are within those portfolios, the communication between those respective departments internationally will be severely limited, and that they would rather speak with Likud than speak with religious Zionist representation because of the reputation and historical things associated with those figures. So that is going to be challenging for Benjamin Netanyahu, because I think one of his unique selling points was that he had built and developed relationships with foreign leaders. And if that is seen to be eroded by the presence of them within government, this could become a bit of a rocky time. It's certainly, though, I think, the most potentially stable governing arrangement since the 2015 election. I think that it does have that going for it because there are 64 seats, four parties who broadly agree on many, many things. But the religious Zionists are such an unknown quantity that you can never really be sure.
And not only does the coalition partners sense you have the religious Zionists wanting the security portfolios, but Shaz, which is one of the religious parties, wants a finance ministry. Now, then again, you have a problem because one of the ministers he once appointed, the finance minister, reportedly the attorney general has blocked the appointment because they were convicted of financial crimes. A little bit controversial, therefore, to have somebody convicted of financial crimes in the finance portfolio. So although I would say that on paper, there are some things going for it. There are only going to be four parties in this coalition rather than eight parties. And they're ideologically tighter in the sense that we've got center-right to right-wing. We have a far-right party and a religious parties. They're much more ideological each other. Theoretically, it can hold the government closer together. But in reality, it's going to be a lot harder indeed.
Yeah, I think the ideological closeness of these parties is clearly stronger than the outgoing government of Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett. But as I said, I think the fact that there are such divergences between Likud's outward presentation than religious Zionist outward presentation, that there could be conflicts to come. And we cannot be certain that this doesn't end up in an election again quite quickly. But I think out of all the five elections that have taken place in the last 4 years, it does seem to have the potential to be the most stable, I think.
Well, for example, one option is that, and maybe for the government's long-term success, but whether it is actually something in which the leaders of Shas and religious Zionists will need to do, is look at the opinion poll. An opinion poll was published that believed that 71% of Israelis do not think that the Shas leader is fit to serve as finance minister because of those convictions for financial crimes and corruption. And 56% think that the leader of religious Zionists is not fit to serve as defense minister. Now, doesn't mean you can not yet nominate yourself for that. You can get your fellow party members to fill it, but that would require them setting aside their ambitions for the good of their parties. And for, I reckon in particular, for religious Zionists, which hasn't been in government before, that lure of being in government before, and for a figure who has not been in government before, I just can't see that working in terms of standing aside. He was the transport minister from 2019 to 2020, but that's a minor position compared to defense minister within this government as well. And finance, I mean, finance is, you know, the cream of, you know, often seen as the top, one of the top cabinet positions. And that's something in which the Shas leader, Ari Darius, never helped for. Mm. So I just can't see that happening.
Just quickly before we close our section on Israel, I just wanted to say one word about the state of the opposition, because I think this is another crucial thing, because I think Yair Lapid has managed to position himself as an opposition ringleader, because his Yesh Atid party did very well in this election as an individual party. Unfortunately, it didn't have the allies or votes necessary to be able to form a government. But do you think he's managed to put himself in a position that means that if this government does start to implode, or the religious Zionists end up being as controversial as they are on paper, do you think Yair Lapid has put himself in a position to potentially be a rallying point for anti-Netanyahu figures once again, or has his time been and gone?
I don't think his time has been and gone yet, but I will say this. I don't think it works with the current parliament. I don't think that the religious Zionists, particularly given who Yair Lapid will likely call upon for coalition partners like the Labour Party, like Benny Gantz, would likely want to move over to the other side of the coalition equation and back him for this prime minister. So I think within this current parliament, it is unlikely, and will have to be another election. But I will say this, though. It doesn't mean that that will exclude him from the next election. I think there's ample evidence. And particularly, I think his little period as alternative prime minister has probably bought him enough credibility in the bank to, for the next election, be it in 3 years, or more likely than not, less than 3 years, given the issues we talk about with the ministers, given Netanyahu himself is still the subject of corruption allegation, I think he still will be a credible person in this conversation within the next election. But nonetheless, I do think that he is still vulnerable to a star candidate coming onto the scene. But as I can't see anybody yet, I have to opt for Yair Lapid and Yesh Atid still being a credible force for the opposition come the next election.
So to put you on the spot, Chairman, before we move on to Australia, will we be back within the next 3 years, or is this government going to last?
Yes. Care to think of how long this government will last, Sam?
My gut says a similar length as the last one, so maybe we'll be back in 18 months.
I was going to go about 2 years, so I don't think we're very far off there.
So, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. We'll now be moving on to talk about an election that hasn't happened yet, and we'll be previewing the upcoming state election in Victoria, Australia, where Premier Daniel Andrews is looking for a third term for his Labour government, and to become only the third Labour Premier in Victoria to win three consecutive elections. Currently, the Labour government has 55 seats in the Legislative Assembly, and a loss of 10 seats will mean minority government. He'll be facing off against opposition leader Matthew Guy, whose party needs to gain 18 seats to form a majority government. And even though the Liberal Party have had an alternative leader since then, this is actually a rematch of the 2018 election. So we have Matthew Guy versus Daniel Andrews for Premier once again. And the remaining 5 seats we haven't discussed at the moment go to Independents and also the Green Party, who tend to be quite strong within the Melbourne area. So, Chern, there's a lot of things going on in this election. Daniel Andrews running for a third term. Let's talk about him. How has the last 4 years been? And because of that, do we expect him to sprint to re-election, or is this election a bit tighter than that?
Well, before I talk about, I think, 3 defining issues of this election, would you like to hear a fun story and why Daniel Andrews will have a big incentive to win this election? So in Australia, there's something, if you are the Premier of Victoria, you can have a statue installed in Treasury Place. The caveat is that you need to serve more than 3,000 days in a job. In other words, you have to win 3 terms. Now, four premiers have only been afforded this honour, and Daniel Andrews is trying to be the 5th. This, ironically, this 3,000-day rule was instituted by Jeff Kennett, And I think Jeff Kennett is somebody who we want to avoid history with because he was going, he instituted this 3,000 days rule when it looked like he was coasting to re-election in his third term and a third term as premier. So he thought, yes, I can benefit from having a statue. Then he unexpectedly lost the 1999 state election. And the last time the Liberal Nationals, which was the party that went, came back into power, was 2014. So just some interesting context there. But on to more serious matters about why Daniel Andrews might not actually, this could be an interesting election. Because on paper, there would need to be a quite a big swing for, so it'll need to be a loss of 10 seats for Labour to go into minority and for the Liberal Nationals to gain government because of those independents and Greens, they need 18 seats. So on paper, it seems as if Labour's in a box seat. But I think there are three big issues that have been dominating this campaign. Firstly, health, and in part, the Premier's treatment and handling of the coronavirus pandemic, and why this could be more pertinent now than, let's say, in other places around the world, particularly in this period of time, is the fact that, if you recall, Sam, Melbourne is the was the city that had the most number of lockdowns in the pandemic. So there have been lots of scars, both economic and social scars, left by that.
I mean, they had, and I've got it, I've got a statistic written down. They had six separate lockdowns, which totaled 262 days in total. And in fact, there were 186 days where schools were closed and students had remote learning. So this is, it's almost a year's worth of strict lockdown, which is something that very few other countries in the world experienced to that extent. And it was the only state in Australia that experienced that extent of rolling lockdowns.
Yes, I totally, and that's totally understandable as well. And it really exposed the cracks within the Victoria health system, and particularly something called ramping, which as I understand it, is basically when you're in an ambulance turns up in hospital, there's no hospital beds to transfer into the hospital itself. So you're left in an ambulance outside. That is known as ramping. And that has a wider knock-on repercussions in terms of, you know, in terms of ambulance response times, et cetera, et cetera. So health and the handling of COVID is the first big issue. The second big issue is what I think was one of the issues that led to Daniel Andrews' landslide re-election 4 years ago, which is something called the suburban rail loop, which is a rail loop that basically better connect the growing Melbourne suburbs. It's going to start out in the east and move over towards Melbourne Airport in the west. The opposition brands it as an expensive white, and it's suddenly blown out and suddenly in terms of cost. And certainly right now, why this is an issue, despite the fact it was often thought to swing the election 4 years ago, is the opposition have promised to scrap it and to spend that money to be allocated for transport into the health service. So it's a kind of a health versus economic future economic growth kind of interesting policy choice that the opposite, that Victorian voters are facing. And finally, is the issue of integrity in politics. Now, Sam, integrity in politics is something we have come and talked about at a federal level in Australia with regarding Scott Morrison and his government's inability to bring an anti-corruption commission has cost him votes. Well, I can tell you that in this election, both the Labour Party and the Liberals have been plagued by integrity issues and referred to IBAC, which is a state corruption body. Labour, believe it or not, is subject to four corruption charges at the moment, all of them in some ways involving Daniel Andrews, such as the red shirt controversy. Some of the others alleged wrongdoings are currently the subject of injunctions. So, for example, there are questions over his government's awarding of a contract to unions. There are also wider questions over his wife actually being involved in car hit and run accident when Daniel Andrews was opposition leader. And Daniel Andrews, as a result of his COVID policies, has become a very divisive figure. He's well known in the Victoria electorate. He has had a whole myriad of integrity issues. And this is something the opposition can't exploit, to be honest, because the Liberals, with leader Matthew Guy, and it's been referred to IBAC after his former chief of staff, a guy called Mitch Catlin. And because his then chief of staff, Mitch Catlin, had allegedly asked a billionaire Liberal donor to make $100,000 payments to his own marketing company. So both sides have been plagued by integrity issues. So it seems to me that this election, I think the one conclusion that I'm willing to state this early on is that there could be a lot more teal independence or independence running on a same that we saw in the federal election in May. In places like, in some of the seats like Kooyong and Goldstein at federal level, the state seats could be very vulnerable, given this divisiveness of both figures, the issues at play, and the integrity issues playing both sides.
Yeah, I think that's a nice comprehensive rundown of some of the main issues of this campaign. And I'm just going to expand slightly on the COVID one, because I think it's interesting on that point to look across the rest of Australia and how this has gone. Because after we've had this election, all six Australian states plus the ACT will have had elections. And we saw in the ACT, Northern Territory, Queensland, Tasmania and Western Australia, COVID rewarding incumbents. Then the tide seemed to turn when we were in South Australia. The Marshall government was handed a heavy defeat. And then obviously in the federal election, Scott Morrison was also ousted from government. So are we about to see a situation where that trend continues? And we see an ousting of the incumbent government because of their handling of COVID? I'm not sure yet. Or will this be more like the previous elections, which were held across summer 2020 through to summer 2021, late 2021, where incumbents were rewarded for handling of the pandemic? I think that remains to be seen because, yes, Daniel Andrews' personal approval rating has fallen, but it's still net positive. And notably, he still holds a sizable lead over Matthew Guy. So just as we were talking about in the Israel case, I wonder whether just his strength as an incumbent, not in his own right, but relative to the pretender to the throne, might be the key here.
In fact, you took away, my concluding sentence about what my prediction was going to be. So I have to think of something in the spot later. So thank you very much, Sam. I think that's a good opportunity for us to talk about the pretender to the throne, Matthew Guy. Now, Matthew Guy, we should say, has not been opposition leader over the last 4 years. After the drubbing at the election in 2018, he stood down in favor of Michael O'Brien. But Michael O'Brien was seen as a lackluster opposition leader. He suffered, like many opposition leaders in Australia and around the world, in fact, with a lack of publicity. And his party replaced him with Matthew Guy, who at that point wanted a bit more of an attack dot to go against the still then relatively popular Daniel Andrews. So, Sam, if we look at it back in history, Victoria was seen as the crown jewel in the Liberal Party. In fact, it held government for 27 years, just after World War II. But at the federal level that, and at the state level, particularly, as I said, you know, if you look at the last couple of elections, with the exception from 2014, 2018, Labour have been in power in Victoria. So what happened to the Liberal Party in Victoria? And is Matthew Guy the person to try and attempt to arrest this?
I don't know, because Matthew Guy was rejected resoundingly, as you said, in 2018. So I think from a Victorian voter's perspective, I wonder if there will be a lingering feeling there of, why are we being offered the same thing when in 2018 we resoundingly rejected it? Now, obviously, the circumstances within the Liberal Party meant that Michael O'Brien will not get to face an election in his own right, and Matthew Guy was unanimously elected to replace him as leader. I wonder if, in part, because he has been through a statewide election before, he is a known quantity, and just the time to turn it around for somebody completely new may have just been too narrow. So I wonder if that was part of the equation. But I think the other thing is that Matthew Guy obviously has some controversies surrounding him as a figure. Most notably, he said after the first spill motion against Michael O'Brien, and this is a direct quote, "I insist I will not topple the leader before the next election. That is the end of the matter." What did he do less than a year later? Exactly that. He was also fined for breaking mask rules in Parliament House. And also, in a speech commemorating the life of the former monarch of Australia, Elizabeth II, referred to the former King Arthur of the UK, and then was reminded that that was actually a mythical figure rather than somebody who did have the throne. So in that kind of environment, I'm not entirely convinced that Matthew Guy is capable of turning this around. Interestingly, though, I think there's a nice historical point to make here about the Liberal Party. Do you have any interesting anecdotes into why the Liberals faded so significantly and so quickly from Victoria being the bastion of Liberal support around the country to now being somewhere where they're actually just struggling to nudge the Labour Party out of power?
Well, actually, I think the big difference, particularly in this most recent period, was that the regional cities have really gone against the Liberal Party. So cities like Bendigo and Ballarat in the late 90s, in 1999, fell to the Labour Party, and they haven't really won it since. Now, up to 1999, there was often a thought that it was through the eastern suburbs of Melbourne where elections were won or lost. And that has, and but what we did see in 1999 was that Bendigo and Ballarat fell, but the eastern suburbs held firm and gave the Labour Party an alternative method of victory. I think what we're seeing now is that the Liberals are unable to break the Ballarat and Bendigo cities, which was the previously that they held before 1999. In the southeast, which decided the 2014 election, the announced Labour Party sitting on double-digit margins. And in 2018, what gave Daniel Andrews a majority was the eastern suburbs. Those volatile eastern suburbs that didn't swing in 2014 and 1999 did swing to in 2018. So I think the problem that the Liberals had is that they just lost these bases, really, within Melbourne, but on the outs in the suburbs of Melbourne, in the regional cities. And now coupled with the fact in inner Melbourne, they are in deep trouble in some places. Like, can they regain Hawthorne, which was lost last time round, or would that go to a Teal? What about the seat of Kew? These are blue ribbon seats in the middle of in Melbourne, which due to demographic changes, a younger electorate moving in, you know, with different sets of values, not necessarily the rich, which used to be in these seats, that's totally changed the makeup of it. So I just wonder for the Liberals now, they have lost their base and are struggling to find that. And I think that that cannot be ignored about why this crown was slowly being slipped, is that Melbourne's expansion has expanded the population overspill from the city of Melbourne to the regional cities in Ballarat, Bendigo, in the southeast, has expanded Labour's battleground, made more seats marginal, and that has really impacted the Liberals in this seat. So I would say population growth can and the differing values can play a big role here.
I think there is an interesting thing here, though, that there's the potential for almost an inverse of 1999 to happen in this election if indeed the Liberals were to go on to win. Because in 1999, a lot of people credited the huge public service cuts and tax reform proposals being rejected in rural, non-metropolitan areas in Melbourne. Whereas now that could be reflected in the inverse if those population centres are rejecting the COVID response from Daniel Andrews, because those are the areas where there were huge school closures, there were lockdown mostly affected them because it's the workers who can't necessarily work from home and are having to commute, so missed out on income, missed out on general livelihood, less connected. So there is the potential for that flip to happen. And that would have to happen if the Liberals and the Coalition are wanting to come out on top in this election. Because it's interesting, you mentioned about the impact of the Teals, which we'll come on to in a second. But if the Liberals were to win this election, as we said at the beginning, they need to pick up 18 new seats without losing any existing seats. Well, 13 of the 21 seats the Liberals held last time were under 3% margins. So they need to hold on to all of those. And there are a couple of them, according to the redistribution pendulum, where they're actually now marginal Labour seats that are currently held by Liberals. So they have to hold that as well. One example being Louise Stalley's Ripon seat, which is now rated at +2.8 for the Labour Party. So it's going to be a tough ask to hold all their existing seats on top of finding a route to gaining a net gain of 18. So that will be interesting, because they're pretty much going to have to run the board on Labour marginals, and they're quite diverse. It's quite a diverse range of seats there, and that's without independents chipping away at their existing blue strongholds, as you alluded to earlier, like Q.
I can't help but think why you chose Ripprins. Is it something similar to your surname or anything like that? But let's just move on from that.
No comment
on why you chose Ripprin. I did think you're going to choose Ripprin. I have to be honest with you. I think you're really right with the Liberals' challenges and this opportunity. I think the one caveat to this is that, unfortunately for the Liberal Party, is that a lot of the seats that it wants to target with these COVID-frustrated voters, particularly in the western suburbs, they are sitting on enormous Labour margins. So it may take more than one election for them to fall. You know, this slow erosion of that Labour margin to get there. I just don't know whether they are fallible in one election.
Yeah, and on top of that, the most recent electoral test we have in Victoria, admittedly, it's a federal, not a state election, we actually saw a good night for the Labour Party because they picked up notably Chisholm and Higgins from the Liberal Party on a swing of, well, in Higgins' case, a swing of 5%, but in Chisholm's case, 7%. And two of the biggest Teal gains also happened to be in this seat. So in the most recent electoral advantage, which was in the recent electoral test, which was barely 6 months ago, the Liberal Party don't have many positives to look at, that they have been rebuilding ground since 2018.
And I think as well, one thing to say is that we talked about why the Labour Party, the Liberals lost ground, and I mentioned population growth, demographics of these new voters. Don't forget what used to be, if you think of the federal Liberals at the scene, people like Josh Frydenberg, Peter Costello, Andrew Peacock, they, I would describe, are small L Liberals, i.e. economic Liberals, but crucially socially Liberals as well. So as the social conservatism and, like, for example, figures and more right-wing figures like John Howard, Peter Dutton, for example, rose in prominence, that really toxified the brand of what worked for Victorian Labour, for the Victorian Liberals for so many years. So, but in this election, Matthew Garr has actually voted, before this election, he voted in favour of banning conversion therapy and in trying to create a state-based treaty with Indigenous people. So clearly on the social policy front, he's trying to keep that Liberal lane. I suspect, A, in a notch to how Liberals had won in the past and where the big Liberal figures in terms from Victoria, what their policy preferences are. But unfortunately, he could be undone by some of his more controversial candidates. For example, just over the last few days, he has already told the person who is number one on the ticket of the Eastern Metropolitan Region, a woman had ties to a controversial far-right group which openly advocated for conversion therapy. So whilst the leader might try and say something to try and win back these socially Liberal voters that had previously voted for the Victorian Liberals and kept their power for so long, if there's bill digging, like some of the candidates have been doing in the last week, and some of their preference deals with alleged Nazis and the angry Victorian parties, I wonder if that might sow enough doubt in voters' minds within the Liberals. And actually, what they may do is vote independent. Because, Sam, let's be honest, in the last election, Australian voters have shown that they are willing to not vote for the major parties, isn't it? So are we likely to see the same impact as the Teal independents in this state election?
Well, I think certainly the campaign would suggest that we might be seeing a few of those similarities, because there have been a raft of high-profile independent campaigns which are seen as absolutely potential winners in their respective districts, just to name a few. And the key asterisk here is it's not just independents who might be causing problem for the Liberals, because there are an equal number, really, of independents who could be causing a problem for the Labour Party as well. On the Teal side, which is the Liberal problem, particularly you have a high-profile independent campaign in the seat of Q in Northern Kooyong, which was, obviously we know on the federal side, was Josh Frydenberg's seat, which he lost spectacularly. Well, this seat, for a whole host of reasons, is going to be prominent in this election because it is the seat of the outgoing former Attorney General Tim Smith, who resigned from the Shadow Cabinet and will be standing down as the representative for that district. So we'll be having two new figures. The actually, the new Liberal candidate used to work for Josh Frydenberg, so it'll be interesting to see if they suffer the same fate as their former boss. But there is a high-profile Teal Independent campaign from Sophie Tawney, so that will be interesting to watch. On the Labour side, I think a great one is Point Cook, which interestingly is the seat of the former outgoing Attorney General as well, but on the Labour side this time, Jill Hennessy, who will be standing down. And there is a high-profile independent campaign there from Dr. Joe Gara, who ran a strong campaign in the neighbouring seat of Werribee back in 2018. But since then has been boosting his profile substantially because he made numerous TV appearances throughout the COVID-19 pandemic on the virus, lockdowns, the impact of various health control measures. So is expected to do quite well in his own right as well. So those are just two of quite a number of high profile independent campaigns that reside in seats which do fit within the federal constituencies of the seats where Teals did quite well. So Goldstein was another Teal pickup back in the spring. Well, Goldstein shares some of its land and boundaries with another high-profile Teal campaign, this time in Caulfield. So there, wherever you look across this electoral map, there are high-profile independents who could throw a spanner in the works.
And interestingly, Caulfield, which is the seat that you mentioned, first of all, the redistribution was not kind. And if you want a bit of deja vu, the current Liberal candidate is David Southwick, the deputy leader of the Victorian Liberals. Now, whether he fell to the same fate as the deputy leader of the federal Liberal Party, well, we only have 1 week to go. I think for me, there's one seat that I think could be very interesting, which is a couple of seats that I'm looking in terms of other parties that could potentially upset the margin is Albert Park. Albert Park, theoretically, is a safe margin of 13%, but it is losing the incumbent minister. The incumbent minister was the former health minister, Martin Foley. He's retiring. And this is a seat, Sam, where the Greens could be a very interesting port to play. It is McNamara was a classic three-way marginal in the federal election. I wonder what that impacts here. I think the Greens could have very good chances in places like Richmond to take the seat there. Again, another retiring minister, Richard Wynne. So I think in the city itself, the Greens could have certain advantages.
But the key difference here, though, is really, and if you disagree with this, please feel free. But if a Teal independent ousts a Liberal, it's unlikely they will prop up a Liberal government. But if a Green member ousts a Labour member, if push comes to shove, it's likely that the Greens will agree to prop up the Labour Party. And that's the key asterisk here, isn't it?
Well, they're already directing preferences. So I think that does tell you towards the Labour Party over. I think logic tells me they will probably favour that. I know you're a big tennis fan, Sam. So the other seat I was going to pick is Nepean, the state's most marginal seat on the Labour side. Sam, do you know who the Liberal candidate is there?
I don't, but I look forward to it.
Sam Groth is the Liberal candidate, who is a former professional... And he is a former tennis player. And interestingly, and this is where I would like to see the swing against the Labour Party. Privately, Labour people have conceded already, but I think this is a seat which is on the edge, right at the edge. You know, there's a peninsula. It's right at the edge of the Mornington Peninsula. But Daniel Andrews classified this as Melbourne. That meant he was unable to enjoy some of the regional benefits in a regional city of unlocking earlier. Mm. So if I were to suggest two seats, that and Pakenham, which has changed hands in the redistribution, these are seats where the COVID issue could be white hot in terms of the fact that they flipped to Labour for the last time round. And now I think that they could be white hot in terms of that rage that we see in the outer suburbs, the growing outer suburbs that we see, particularly as people move out of the city, exacerbated by COVID, wanting to get into these regional areas, and now the services there have come under strain.
For me, there's one more seat I will add into the mix, because I think the result in this seat will be a strong indicator of how this night is going to go, which is the seat of Bayswater, which is a Labour seat, which they won back in 2018, but has only voted Labour twice in the history of its existence as a seat, once in 2002, once in 2018, which were two of the largest Labour seat tallies in the state's history. So if the Labour Party were to hold on to Bayswater, it would suggest that Labour is having a very good night. And this is one of those seats that the Liberals must win if they're going to win this Victorian election. Because the crucial thing here is that the Bayswater in the redistribution has been now rated as a marginal Liberal seat. And because of redistribution, it's merged with a neighbouring Liberal seat, which will now see two incumbent representatives facing off against each other, the Labour incumbent versus the Liberal incumbent. And I think if you wanted a microcosm of the entire contest, this is the kind of seat I'd be looking at, because there's no incumbency benefits because they're both incumbents. It has only voted Labour twice, both in times when Labour has done exceptionally well. But who knows? Because it's currently a Labour-held seat, and demographics in that kind of area would suggest that if Labour are having a good night, this will be a hold.
Well, lots of drama in so many seats there. And one thing that I will say is a nice story, but I think will be really interesting to see a Hawthorne. Now, Hawthorne in 2018 had the then incumbent MP at the unfortunate being on television and being told that he has lost his seat, which is, he handled it very well, but it is something in which I don't think he's going to be on television again this time around. But that was John Pesutto. The Labour candidate is again facing off for a second term against John Pesutto, who is coming back for a second try. And there is an independent Melissa Low, and this is in the seat of Kooyong. So all the mix of Australian politics.
There's three seats in that area, Hawthorne, Kew, and I think it's Box Hill, which all sit in the little part of Melbourne, which is the intersection between the two big Labour pickups of Chisholm and Higgins and Kooyong as well. So it's all in that area where on the federal level, there was a good result for people who are not the Liberal Party. I'll put it that way.
Well, Sam, time is fast running on this podcast. And frankly, we can just talk about all 88 seats, frankly, and how and they all have an interesting story to tell. But for time's sake, let's end on that usual question. Predictions. What do you think is going to happen next Saturday?
I think the Labour Party will have a net loss of seats, but I think it will be stemmed to the point that they will retain majority status in Victoria. I think Daniel Andrews's preferred Premier advantage over Matthew Guy will be crucial here. And I think just having talked through the seats, the map for a Liberal win, I think, is just too difficult and is beyond the capabilities of the Liberal Party in this moment. It would be a huge surprise to me if the Liberal Party were to win a majority here. But you never know, because stranger things have happened in politics. But my gut tells me Labour will hold on to its majority. What do you think, Chern?
I think we could get a seats count similar to Daniel Andrews' first victory. It's about 47 seats. So you're looking at a net loss of about 8, which will be a small but relatively comfortable majority. I think the context of 2018, particularly at the federal level, cannot be clearer. In 2018, we just had the ouster of the economic and social liberal Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, who was popular in Victoria, and he was ousted by the Conservative faction over issues related to energy and climate change. And Matthew Guy, at that point, ran a law and order, crackdown African gangs message that really turned off voters. And I think what that has done is inflated Labour's margin and Labour's, you know, and they will suffer a net loss. I don't think there could be anything regarding that. But I think the big difference is that we had a Liberal federal government and a Labour state government. So we know, Sam, many of these countries with federal systems, they like different parties of different stripes to control federally and state. Now we have a Labour federal government, although be it early on, there's been a honeymoon phase at the federal level. But I wonder, the only thing that can think to me is that Labour minorities, that they do not want a government of the same stripe. I think if enough of these voters turn feel this way because Australia is compulsory voting. It could push Labour into minority, but even then, they will have a crossbench of the Greens and some of the independents to work with for a functional majority in the parliament. So I think Daniel Andrews would get that, but I think his time, he needs to think about succession planning. I think that's been really clear in these results. So to me, that he will probably get his statue, but I think it will be very much a case of trying to get to 45 in this election and then thinking about whether we can get new leadership in. He just lost his deputy premier for most of the last 8 years. James Molino is retiring in our eastern suburb seat. It's probably time for new blood to come in.
Yeah, well, I think the crucial thing for Daniel Andrews to look at is the fact that the other two Labour premiers of Victoria who won third terms, within the first 2 years of that third term, they had been removed or they had resigned. So it could be, if Daniel Andrews is successful and sees out the fourth third term, he could become Victoria's longest serving Labour premier. But it remains to be seen. And we don't have too long to wait because we will be looking at the results of this election in a couple of weeks' time. But for now, that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again when we'll be doing a final wrapping up of the US midterms and also be talking about the recent Indian state election in Himachal Pradesh. And as always, we will continue to keep you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world on our social media pages. You can follow us on Twitter, if it survives, Instagram and Facebook @ballot_talk. And please do leave us a rating or review or simply tell your friends about us. My name is Sam, and until next time, we'll speak to you soon.
Oh my god, I can't believe I was waiting. We survived an hour to get to that point.